This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with a veteran of the Big Red One, the 1st Infantry Division. He served in North Africa with the 26th Regiment, Company B. He's a recipient of the Silver Star, the Bronze Star, and the Purple Heart. He minimizes that injury as a few pieces of rock that struck him in the arm. He's a humble guy, but a great storyteller. And when we left off, Jerry Countess was telling us the story of how he earned the Silver Star, rescuing a sergeant who was outnumbered and hiding behind a tiny rock.
I looked up the hill, and I saw that black spot, and I realized now I knew what it was. It was the guy's machine gun, and I didn't know what I would do. While I was looking at that, a guy came up behind me, one of my people. He called me. He said, "What are you doing over here?" I said, "I'm not supposed to be here, but I was supposed to go around here, but the sergeant is up there, and he's stuck behind the rock." He said, "He ain't going to be there long." I said, "I know. What do I do? I have to get him out." He says, "If you get this guy out of there, he's going to be so visible to these guys that he may have to run 50 yards. He ain't never going to make it. Of course, they're going to shoot him." It made sense. I understood what he was saying. And an idea occurred to me. I have no particular reason why. I said, "Do you have ammunition?" He said, "Yeah, I got some." I said, "Do you have any armor-piercing ammunition?" Armor-piercing is different. It's special ammunition designed for that particular purpose. In theory, it was supposed to penetrate German tanks. It didn't always do that, but it was a lot tougher than the regular bullets. He said, "Yeah, I got a couple of things." I said, "Look, give me two of those rounds." Each piece of stuff that it was stuck into had six bullets in it. So he was going to give me 12. He said, "What are you going to do with it?" I said, "I'm going to try to take down that machine gun nest up there." He said, "You can't see anybody. You can't see them close enough to hit them." I said, "I'm not worried about hitting them. What I want to do is hit the parapet," which was rocks. Mm-hmm. They had built it, big rock, this big, but they built it around them. I said, "If I can blow up those rocks, the pieces of rock with the shrapnel might get a guy or two, and they'd be so busy, this guy could run away." He said, "His life is going to depend upon you doing it." I talked to the sergeant briefly. I said, "Look, I'm going to fire at them. I want to keep them occupied for a while. If you hear me shooting and you don't hear any bullets coming down at you, you can take off. It's the best I can do." He said, "Okay." What I did is, instead of being where I was, I went a little further downhill, because there was a big shrub I saw. Not a big shrub. A medium-sized shrub that I saw. Give me some protection for a while. They'd have to find out where I was shooting from. So I took off my hat and I went down maybe 20 yards. I don't know how far. And there was a shrub, and I got into the shrub, and I laid down behind it, and I took out my rifle, and I pushed it through the shrub. Just to test, I shot one or two shots, not the armor piercing, but I shot my regular gun. Went 50 yards to the left of where I was shooting, and I realized what I was doing is looking through my scope. I was looking, the back part was on my gun, but the left part wasn't on my gun, which is facing this way. It was on a bush. So I was shooting 25, 35 yards. Fortunately, they were a little busy up there, so I saw what it was, and I was able to move my gun, and now I had the gun. And I yelled to the first sergeant. I said, "Okay, we're going to go." And I started to shoot at them. The first shots that I had, they fired back where I was. Not exactly where I was, but they were firing. But what happened is the armor-piercing bullets really blew some of those stones apart. And apparently, it hit two people. I heard screams from one of them. I don't know what happened with the other one. But once I knew that I had hit him, then I used the second armor-piercing thing, to do some more. While I was doing that, the first sergeant got out, came down a few feet, and turned off to the left and ran on behind, and he got out safe. I think that I really quieted that machine gun nest. They weren't shooting anymore. I got my helmet, and I took off. I think I really got them bad enough so that was inoperative at that time.
Well, and you just said something. You said, "I got my helmet and I took off." That implies you didn't have your helmet while you were shooting at him.
No,
explain to us why you didn't have your helmet on.
Because I was behind a bush. The helmet is an unnatural thing. It's a shiny. It doesn't show sunlight reflection, but it's a solid piece of stuff this big and that round. So when they're looking at it, it's not nature. It's not part of nature. I could have put the hat 10 feet away on the ground. They would have known that. If they were smart, they would have seen it was on the ground. It wasn't on anybody's head.
So was that just instinct, or had you been taught that?
that was instinct. Nobody talked. You learn a lot of things by yourself when they're shooting at you.
What do you think would have happened to him if you weren't there and if you didn't do what you did?
He would have been turned into pulverized powder. With that machine gun from where they were, and there were two machine guns up there, I think, if he even moved, they were already reducing the size of the piece of stone he was behind. If they had done a little more of that, that would have blown to pieces. Either the pieces would have gotten him or they would have seen him. Now, he had to go maybe 25, 35 yards to get out and around the mountain. That would have given them enough time to really take him apart with the machine gun.
So there's no question you saved his life.
He didn't think there was any question about it, yeah.
But you risked your life to save his.
You risk your life every day when you're in a firing area. You know, whatever you do, you're doing. That was nothing special. If it was me, I would have wanted some other guy come along to try to do something to save me. You know, That was normal.
Well, and if people get your book, Letters from the Battlefield in Love and War, they'll realize you had some other close calls. One of them involves a cave and a Tommy gun and almost killing some guys who you were afraid were going to hunt you down and kill you.
That was part of learning, yeah.
Yeah, and okay. I hope people will get the book so they can read that story. But if I were to say, what was your closest call? Realizing that you're there in North Africa in 1943, then in Italy all the way past Germany's surrender in Europe. So you're over there a long time. I'm sure you had a lot of close calls. What was the moment where you felt you came closest to not coming home and trying to track down that special lady again?
Something that happened when we were attacking the Germans in Sicily. I saved a good part of my company. It had been was not intentional. I didn't know I was going to be doing it. Sicily is a huge collection of mountains, one after another, every way you look. Half of my company went up to the top of a certain area, and my job at that time was, I wasn't a typical fighting soldier. I was like the runner. Mm-hmm. My job was, remember, we didn't have cell phones at that time. we had a phone that was carried on a thing like this, and it worked when you turned the handle. But the battery died quickly. Sometimes it died and you didn't even know it died. It didn't always work, and even when it worked, you weren't sure you were going to get battle headquarters. They went up there, and they were doing their job, you know, fighting the enemy, and all of a sudden, the Germans had new recruitment or whatever. They were really pounding on these people. Unexpectedly, these guys didn't expect to have that many people up there. They were in serious trouble. I had gone up to tell the captain something or whatever that from here, and that's what happened. Oh, my God, you could see stuff flying all over the place. He said, you got to go down and tell them. He said, otherwise, by half an hour from now, we're going to be dead. He said, go down. You're the runner. You know which way to go. You know where the group is. Go get them and tell them. So I ran down that mountain. I have to say, most of the time, I wasn't running. I was flying. I jumped going down from one, maybe 20 feet, 15 feet down, landed, fell over, got up, and kept running. It was a nightmare.
With enemy fire coming in the whole time?
Coming in, but not specifically. I mean, it was coming all over the place.
Sure.
The real danger to that was I could have broken a leg or broken an ankle. That would have been put me into real problems.
Because then you wouldn't have been able to get out.
I wouldn't have been able to get out. And if they took over the captain and his crew up there, they were going to come down.
Yep.
And I'd have been up the creek without a paddle.
Yep.
But, you know, lives of 10, 15, 20 guys are up there. So I had to go. I went down that mountain. I would never do that again in my life. But I was young. I was full of energy and strong. And driven by the necessity, I was more frightened than if they were shooting at me specifically. Just going down because I knew time was of the essence. I had to get down there as soon as I can. Or if I got down a long time, they wouldn't be alive.
So you made it in time.
I made it in time. I got the guy, and they had a phone that was working, not well, but working. They notified the artillery, and the artillery started shooting up at there, and the guys got out. Most of them got out. A few were hurt or wounded, one or two were killed. But basically, most of them got out.
So you made it. You saved their lives in the process. You avoided your life being taken. And here's another thing. You getting hit and killed, obviously, is not the ending you're looking for, but your being captured could have been equivalent. I've heard a lot of stories from people who were captured by the Germans. If depending on where you were, if the Germans found out about your Jewish heritage, have been in the end for you.
Yeah, it might have. Absolutely. I'll tell you a story about being captured. This was when I first joined, and I really didn't know very much. Remember, I told you that there were 8 different marching commands. This was maybe 3 or 4 weeks after I joined. We came to a place with a couple of mountains like this. So they gave us the command to march in a straight line, one behind the other. One platoon, 38, 36 guys, 3 or 4 squads. I was in the second squad, and we started to go up the hill. The Germans did something very clever. They stayed on both sides of where we were marching. Mm. When we went up halfway up, they went in this way. What they did is made it impossible for the guys in the back to shoot them because our guys were in the front. Mm-hmm. The guys in the front couldn't shoot back. Of course, we were in the back. So these guys took the front group lock, stock, and barrel. They got them, and we couldn't shoot at them. They took them away. So we lost 15, 14, something number of guys like that.
So if you had been on that half of where the Germans came in?
I'd have been up the creek. At any rate, I just want to finish this story. A year and a half, 2 years later, the war ended. And I was one of the first guys to be picked to go back home because of the number of different points I had, irrelevant. So I got back and on the boat, and there are a couple thousand guys on the boat, and we were very lucky. Instead of the terrible weather we had going back, this was July, the weather was beautiful, the ocean was flat, and so I got on the boat. There were a couple thousand guys in there. Nobody wanted to sleep below. It was impossible. But we stayed up on top of the boat all day. I got to the rail of the boat, and I see some people I know, and we're talking. And I turn around, and I see about 15 feet behind me, there's another small group of guys talking. There's one guy standing there looking at me. We went down, we had lunch, I came back up again. And I go back to the same place, and there's the same guy there, and he's still looking at me, and he smiles. I don't know exactly what he was aiming at, but I didn't say anything. He came over to me. He said, "Hello, Jerry." He says, "You don't remember me?" "No, I don't remember you." He says, "I was in your platoon." Not in your squad, but in your platoon. That is, platoon's 48, 50 people, so 4 squads, maybe 12 in each one. Mm-hmm. He was in the squad immediately before me on that hill. He was 2 guys ahead of me, and the Germans went between us.
Wow.
He was taken to Germany, and he worked in a German factory for almost the full 2 years making tanks.
Wow.
He says, "You can be sure that a lot of those tanks had deficiencies."
Uh-huh. He sabotaged
But them. That's where he was. So, yeah, he and a couple of other people obviously did that. But he spent the entire time that we went through all this crazy stuff. He was in a factory, getting up in the morning, working in the factory all day at night. And I asked him, I said, "Would you rather have been with us instead of in the factory?" He said, "No."
Uh-huh.
I understand. But what a coincidence, you know.
Yeah, and I guess that's a, hey, that could have been me moment.
If they'd have come up a little further, I was two guys away from him.
Mm-hmm. And you were helpless, unable to fire because
couldn't
you would
fire.
Have been hitting couldn't your own
fire.
People.
Right.
I know your story has so many twists and turns, and hopefully people listening are intrigued enough that they'll go online at hometownheroesradio.com and find the links to your book, Letters from the Battlefield in Love and War. But I think we can let them know how that story ended. If you have all these letters in this book and you found them somehow, what happened with that young lady you'd asked to marry?
She was working as a nurse in a hospital without any superiors, so they had to do a lot more work. They were working 12 hours a day, 14 hours a day in the hospital. They were the nurses. When she knew she was going home, I knew that I would be going home relatively shortly. I didn't know when. The war ended. I got there. She wasn't there. She had already gone home. They had released her. So I went back to Brooklyn, and I knew the building she lived in. I knew which train went there because that's where I used to go to all the time.
Yeah.
I told her on the phone that I was coming, and when I got there, I got to the apartment house. I was very impressed by the apartment house. It was the only apartment building I'd ever seen that had an elevator in it. She lived on the ground floor. I never used it, but I was very impressed by the elevator. So I finally went down a long hall. I got to the door of her house. She had been smart enough to tell her mother and father to take a hike for a while. I got to the door. I couldn't wait. Knocked on the door, rang the bell, no answer. Knocked on the door, rang the bell, no answer. Knocked on the door, and suddenly I heard a voice on the other side. She said, "Yeah, it's me." I said, "Okay, open the door." "No." I said, "Open the door." "No." "Why?" "I can't." It's been too long. I can't. I got so furious. I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to break that door down. I'm going to back up and go charging at the door. And if I get killed trying to break through that door, I heard a click. The door was open, unlocked. And I went in. Out of a clear blue sky, one of her relatives, her older sister, had a husband who was unexpectedly rich, and he decided that he was going to make the marriage for us. And they did it in the basement of his house. They invited about 100 people, all relatives. I had no relatives. I have no sisters, no brothers, no aunts, no uncles, no cousins, nothing. It was just my mother, my grandmother, and me.
Mm-hmm. But all that time that you're overseas, all the times your life could have ended, and again, she'd already said no to you once, but it works out that you come back, you find her again, you marry, you have children and grandchildren, and all these years together. That's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I think I'm one of the luckiest guys alive.
And I don't think anyone who's listened for the last hour is going to disagree with that. Thank you, Jerry, for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your story. Thank you for giving us something to shoot for when we're 94, Lord willing. Go to hometownheroesradio.com for more info on Jerry's book. And join us again next time as we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.